Hi everyone, this is Alex. I hope that you've enjoyed Sequential Statement so far. Wanted to let you know that this is going to be the last episode that follows the current format. Nick and I are starting to learn more about what we're interested in talking about and how we're going to bring that to you, our listeners. So in the spirit of evolving and growing and learning, next month we'll be trying out some new stuff, and I hope that it'll be more fun for you and will give us the flexibility to do some of the things that we've been thinking about for a while. So for this episode, I hope you enjoy, and I hope to see you back at the end of next month. Thanks.
Hi, you're listening to Sequential Statement, a monthly comics review podcast brought to you by Sequential State. Sequential State is a comics criticism project dedicated to thoughtful commentary and reviews of alternative and independently published comics. I'm Alex.
And I'm Nick.
And this is episode number 4. Check us out at www.sequentialstate.com and follow the podcast on Tumblr at sequentialstatement.tumblr.com, where you can find links to things discussed in this episode and see additional show notes. We're also available on SoundCloud and on Stitcher, so feel free to follow us at your favorite podcasting platform of choice. So, Nick, you wanted to talk a little bit today about, what was it again?
So Diamond Distribution, which, you know, does like all the big, you know, comics distribution for most like direct market stores. They have every year Free Comic Book Day. It's a pretty big deal now. Most people know it. It's basically the biggest comic book retailer holiday there is out there. But they also have a second program called Halloween Comics Fest, which was this weekend for most retailers, or most retailers, you know, try to do it this weekend. The store I work at in my free time, they celebrated this year, and I got to work that. And I just went ahead some random thoughts about it. You know, something I recognize is that, number one, Halloween Comics Fest is a much less known event than Free Comic Book Day is. But the nice thing was that we had a lot of kids show up, and we had a lot of families with their kids, and they dressed up in costumes. That was a lot of fun. We gave out candy and things like that. We had a lot of parents who came and picked up kids' books, which was great. Mostly we're just talking like DC or some Marvel books that have some superheroes or, you know, characters that they may know, like Adventure Time or Scooby-Doo, that kind of thing. But we offered parents like 4 for $1 books, and we noticed that there were a lot of people taking advantage of that and building up their kids' comic collections, but just kind of pushing reading. So for the most part, I've always enjoyed Free Comic Book Day because I thought that it's like a literary event or a kind of literary focused rather than the collecting side necessarily of comics. There's a lot of push on that event as a readership type event, which I'm always excited about.
So from the Indian alt comics perspective, most of the stuff I see about Free Comics Day is like folks offering digital copies of their comics for free, and then there's like giveaways at comic stores. Does that sound about right? What time of year is that?
So the Free Comic Book Day happens the first weekend of May every year, the first Saturday of May. And you're basically, yeah, right on there. For the most part, every big company and a lot of the smaller publishing houses do put out a free book for Free Comic Book Day. Fantagraphics did one last year, and they've done one for the number of years. Usually Drawn Quarterly has a book for that event. It's just basically a giveaway for the store anyway. There's a small fee that retailers do pay for those. But usually it's a, you know, like something like 20 cents per book. It's pretty small, but the retailer typically eats it. Then they add a sale into that day to kind of recoup their any losses from that. But it is, on one hand, an incredible brand builder for Diamond. But it's a great way to actually get people in the doors. And, you know, if you're handing out free comics one day, hopefully you can get people hooked or, you know, back onto books or whatever, and get them reading again. But, you know, there's set free books that everyone does, and some retailers do it differently than others. My store gives out between three and five books every year to people, with, you know, some exceptions and changes here and there. Some people probably give out, you know, one or two, depending on the size of their store. But it's just a nice way to get people in the doors and get them to actually, you know, start reading or collecting comic books.
It's kind of like a trick or treat sort of thing. This October 31st, this Halloween,
yeah,
giveaway.
And Halloween Comics Fest kind of falls, you know, wherever it can. This year it just happened to fall on actual Halloween, but it's typically like your last Saturday of October, as close to Halloween as possible. And they do kind of try to incorporate trick or treat a little bit. They encourage stores to, you know, do things like face painting, or, you know, have the kids come in costumes and give out candy and things like that. When you look at the crop of books between this time and Free Comic Book Day, you notice there's a lot more books aimed at youths and aimed at kids. They do a lot more mini, you know, smaller, I don't want to say necessarily mini comics, because they're not the typical black and white fare that most indie readers would find. But they're definitely smaller publications, thin and pretty, you know, short and all that. Not your typical, like, not your typical size comic book, but it's a great time for, you know, really the focus on this one was really more kids than adults. Whereas Free Comic Book Day is kind of pushing a little bit more toward adults. We had a lot of books for adults last year. I keep thinking that there was a Hip Hop Family Tree book that came out a couple years ago, and some others that are, you know, in that similar vein as far as indie books go. This time you were seeing a lot more things that were just aimed at youth. And I was just really excited. I was really excited to see kids there. I was really excited to see their parents getting excited. It was a really good event. And so I was excited about it, and it made me really, really happy about the future of comics.
Yeah, I think that any way that you can get kids more involved with reading, I think that that's great. Like, I think it's kind of awesome to have like a comic book literary kind of giveaway. Like, Free Comics, or there's been kind of this movement in like the Halloween candy sort of thing, where it's like they want to give away toys because kids have allergies and et cetera. Like, so some folks don't actually even give out candy anymore. They just give away like crafts or toys or like things that are not, you know, toxic to someone, let's say, that has a peanut allergy or whatever. So in that vein, I think that's kind of cool. And if I had been a 7-year-old, I would have loved to have gone to a comic store to get free comics on Halloween. That would have been right up my alley. So yeah, hopefully that builds more readership. I think, like, as long as the comics were, like, specifically focused at kids, I think that that's the perfect mix. Like, you mentioned Adventure Time. Probably some of the other Boom licenses were in that mix. And those cartoon tie-ins are super important, especially when it turns to increasing readership. Like, I know that Adventure Time in particular has been a really big pull for younger readers who want more stories in that universe, and have turned kind of to the comics to do that.
Yeah, I don't think they actually did an Adventure Time book this year, but we did have some Adventure Time books that we were selling to people as part of the event. But yeah, I believe that Boom did have a book out, and I can't remember what it was. And you know, one of the things that we did have was a really neat one. It was a Scooby-Doo meets the Justice League. So a little bit of something for both, you know, for kids. It's got the cartoon characters for their parents who know the comics. It's got some characters for them. So something they can bond over, which is great. But yeah, it was a really great event. I'm a big proponent of comics for all ages, comics for kids. And this was a great event. So hopefully it does continue to build and grow. And I just want to see, you know, more kids show up to the shop and have their parents come with them and pick up comics. So that's always exciting for me.
Yeah, it sounds like it was a good time.
Yeah.
So we are going to start, I think, with our first review. We're going to talk about a new retrofit book, Ikebana, by Yumi Sakugawa. Yumi is the artist and writer of I Think I'm in Friend Love With You, among other books. This is a new release. Ikebana was released, I think, at SPX, which was in September. If you listened to our last episode number 3, we talked a little bit about my experience at SPX. And that's where I picked up this issue. Ikebana is a, it's a book about making art, and it's a book about making art in a kind of more formal way. So the main character is doing performance art for a comics thesis. And so Cassie, she's a fourth generation Japanese American, and she's doing performance art and basically doing a presentation of a senior thesis called organic biopainting ritualized movement piece, focused on the meditative Japanese art of flower arrangement called Ikebana. Iki meaning alive and bana meaning flower. So it follows Cassie through this art piece. The students follow Cassie through the like a ritualized activity. So performance art, something I'm vaguely familiar with. She leaves the performance space and enters into the real world, walks around. A lot of stuff happens out in the real world, a lot of it bad. And then see kind of what happens as the story progresses. It's Sakugawa's characteristic Tuni style. Sakugawa has the tendency to focus more on the way that art moves and the way it feels rather than super high on craft. This is very much like her other pieces, like I Think I'm in Friend Love with You and Never Forgets, and SPX Ignatz Award nominee from last year, 2014. It has this kind of realism, but then it also has this kind of surrealism. One of the characters that follows the group is a cat-looking person, and then the faculty for this art class is this round, faceless person with a leaf on his head. Maybe an apple or a pear or something for a head. So it has elements of surreal or magical fantasy or magical realism in it, as well as parts of the real world. What did you think about Ikebana?
I was not in love with it. Something that that did strike me, though, and maybe this is a critique on the readers of her work, is that it seems that everyone in the world does not understand the art that that's being put on. And that's kind of the recurring theme. No one really understands what she's trying to get out. And part of that is that she can't comment on what they're saying. You know, she stays silent throughout this entire story. So we just kind of react to who she is and not so much, you know, it's not two-way communication, it's one way. But, you know, that's kind of where I appreciated that idea of others not understanding what you're doing, and you're just kind of left to be silent, you know, a silent face to that, which was interesting. You know, it's an interesting way to look at it. That's kind of what I picked up out of it.
Yeah, there's certainly this the death of the artist sort of thing going on here. I'm a firm believer in that. Everybody has their own kind of way to review or analyze art. I tend to believe that when an artist explains what they're trying to accomplish, that it changes the relationship that the viewer has with the art irrevocably. Not that an artist can't explain what they're trying to do, but any communication that the artist was having with their viewer, their reader, their watcher, any communication that they have with that person is then mired in that explanation.
Right.
So yeah, there certainly is the death of the artist going on here. Cassie doesn't respond to anyone's comments or critiques of her as she moves through the space. There's also a lot of social stuff going on in this book that I think is really interesting. Like, Nick, did you pick up on any of the... I mean, most of it's pretty obvious, but I'm wondering what you thought about, like the sexism and the...
Which part?
It's like pages. It's like in the middle of the book, or like the first third of the book. It's like six pages, like 16, 17, 18, where Cassie is catcalled and verbally assaulted by men that are walking through the space with her that aren't part of her class. She gets all these like leering stares, and people are laughing at her because she's basically in flower pasties and underwear. There's a car that drives by and honks at her, a guy that speaks in Japanese, like belittling her heritage as an Asian person. So like there's a lot of like kind of up stuff that's happening to Cassie while she's doing this performance piece.
Right. And I mean, on one hand, and I don't know how you could take this, one could make the argument that, well, you've opened yourself up to that kind of, you know, criticism, that kind of, you've opened yourself up to those reactions because you've gone out into the real world. You know, you're not behind academia. You are now out there. Your product is out there. I suppose I was really reading this as an allegory for her being the art, her art in general. And now that it's out there, there's nothing she can say about it. It gets, it gets reactions from people that, maybe she didn't want, but her art is out there. You know, it's going to be what it is. And get reactions because of that. Just, that's really what I kind of pulled out from this.
Well, I think that's a good summary of the overall the theme of this work. But I think there's some really interesting social motifs that are writing through that make Ikebana a more complex and nuanced narrative than perhaps just the death of the artist, etc. One of the things that I think Sakugawa is trying to get at with this book is all of the things that society puts in the way of an artist, a woman of color, in making art and presenting it to the world. So we see the classic example of white privilege where a student says, you know, I'm going to rate you poorly, professor, if you don't make this go the way that I want it to. We see that, like I said earlier, the catcalling, the name calling, the verbal and physical threat she receives from even her mother, who doesn't really understand what she's doing, who in addition to belittling her, also is demanding her resources and her time and her effort.
Mm-hmm.
And physically assaults her. I'm interested in what you think about the character with the mask, like the surgical mask.
Just in general?
Yeah, like this person, we have no idea what their thought process is. All the characters, well, the two main characters really in this person in the surgical mask and Cassie are both completely silent throughout. So we don't really have a good understanding of this second character's intentions, other than maybe to perhaps see the art in the way that Cassie wishes for it to be seen. But at one point, this character pulls a X-Acto knife like on Cassie's mom, like in the middle of the street after Cassie's been assaulted. I just think that was kind of like an interesting, kind of throws me off a little bit, you know what I mean? Like it's all of a sudden they're like, you know, we're getting this consistent death of the artist, this is my art in the world and this is how it is, and then all of a sudden there's this moment where it's like, what is this person doing? And what does that mean for that overarching theme or narrative?
Well, I mean, I kind of, to continue that idea, in some ways you could say that is a fan standing up for the work in a way that the artist couldn't, you know, if you want to take it that way. But, you know, I don't know. At that point, the story goes into a kind of strange dreamscape almost, the way that it ends. That characters really are harbinger for the end of the episode. So I guess I don't really, it's so hard. There's the characters are so sparse in this that you don't really get a good sense of anybody. You just kind of, everyone is either a kind of stereotype maybe, or just kind of talk like exists in yelling.
Yeah, well, there is certainly that. Like, I think that the ocean, so one of the things that you notice throughout this storyline is that Cassie starts in this basin of water in academia, so she's standing in a bowl of water, and then at the end of the book, she's in the ocean. Basically, we're moving from a small contained body of water to a large ocean. The idea there being that we're moving from the cloister to academia, or the ivory tower, essentially, and moving out into the real world. So it's another way to visually represent that metaphor.
Right. Although the strange thing is that those two times that she's in the water are the times that she's most safe. She's safe in that bowl in the beginning. There's no critique or really criticism at that point necessarily. And then again, when she's in the ocean, it's a cleansing almost. So I don't really know exactly what that represents necessarily. And again, I can't speak for the author. I don't know. Although that is in theory the idea, is that the author isn't speaking for themselves either.
Yeah, I think it is certainly a lot about the idea of trying to deliver a message or to speak through art and not always knowing where that's going to land. I do think that there is somewhat of a difference. There's that guy with the man bun who, like, does a critique of Cassie's underwear, saying that it reminds him of factory pollution, child labor abuse, global warming, and Fukushima.
Yeah, what a scholarly way of putting that, right?
As soon as I read that page, I was like, well, that's a little up. And then I was like, well, I wonder where this is going to go. Because already, like, you know, in the middle of the piece, we're already seeing this premature critical voice. And I thought that was an interesting way to start, because it's, we haven't even gotten halfway through where the performance art is going to be. And we've already develop these sorts of associations and ideas about what it is and what it can be. And then it substantively changes as she moves into the real world.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, mostly I was just taking it as like, here is your typical college speak. and yeah, maybe that can be said that it is, it's an early overstep.
And then I thought this early piece with this blonde girl was really interesting. Like, the art that Cassie's doing is less valuable because she's not been engaged with the rest of the art making that other students have done. And I'm not sure where to kind of place that in terms of the theme of this story.
Yeah.
Other than to say that perhaps it's an echoing of that same attack of the artist from a different perspective, essentially kind of moving against Cassie because of opinions based perhaps not very thoughtfully, or based in racism or like antagonistic thought, perhaps. As you can see, I'm having a hard time kind of like really wrapping my head around the full breadth of what this story is, because I feel like it's so wide open. Sakugawa's cartooning is relatively simple, and I think that allows you to kind of read more into it. One of the things I think is really interesting about cartoony work is the ability to kind of interpret your own, you know, interpret more about what's going on in the scene using the visual cues and the motion, rather than trying to find facial expression or a twitch here or a, you know, highly detailed. Yeah, I think I'm fascinated by Ikebana because of Sakugawa's cartooning, how it kind of lends itself to interpretation. It's not hyper detailed. It's not realistic because of the things that are going on. We have to kind of put our own interpretation on this work, and I think partially that's what Sakugawa wants, but it's also what she's talking about as an artist in this book. So I think that's kind of interesting.
Right. Yeah, I can appreciate that.
Any final thoughts? It sounds like maybe you felt that this was a little simple, or I'm trying to figure out what your reaction was to Ikebana.
You know, there are definitely layers to pick out of it, but as a whole, I was not really blown away or impressed. I'd like to see what her other work is like, maybe. But you know, for now, I can't say that I was you know, an immediate fan after reading this piece.
Yeah, this is definitely not the easiest one to start with, but it is a, you know, I think it's a good representative piece in terms of her overall body of work. I think this piece kind of gets at the more philosophical things that Sakugawa talks about, although Sakugawa really does spend a lot of time talking about the power of meditative thought and meditation and that sort of thing. So that's a large body of her work. But I think that this piece kind of falls in line with Never Forgets, which is a fascinating piece from last year that on much different themes, but had a lot of similarities when it comes to cartooning style and the arc of the story and the emotional resonance of it. So,
yeah, very good. Well, I will look forward to maybe checking out some other things and seeing how they stack up.
Yeah, if you didn't like Ikebana, I'm not sure if you'd like Never Forgets, but it certainly was a fascinating piece. For me personally, I really loved it. I did a review. You can read that review on sequentialstate.com. Just look up Yumi Sakugawa's name through the search bar and you can easily find it. It came out in about September of last year.
Cool. Well, let me move on to our next book. We have Paper Girls. Art is by Cliff Chang and wonderful Matthew Wilson. Actually, Cliff Chang is also phenomenal, but I have a real soft spot for Matt Wilson's colors. And the story is by Brian K. Vaughan, who is somebody I love and have loved his work. Most people will know him from Saga, also published by Image Comics, and the classics Why the Last Man and Ex Machina, which both were from DC. Anyways, Paper Girls is about newspaper delivery girls in the Cleveland area, which hits close to home for both of us. It's set in the 1980s. And as they are delivering newspapers on Halloween night or the morning after Halloween, they run across something out of this world. And the story ends with a little bit of a change of skyline, which was pretty cool. Although I don't know where this will go. There's some mysterious figures throughout who they are kind of tracking down. Who may or may not be alien in origin, although there's a bit of a reveal at the end that suggests that maybe they are from another time. So I really enjoyed this. I thought it kind of set up nicely. I've got a few irks here and there, but by and large, I think this was a nice setup issue. It was a big double-sized setup issue to get us at least acquainted with some of our characters and their voice as we move on to the full series. Something I've been noticing in Brian K. Vaughan recently is that he's using these like first issues as really his like world building issue, to get us into what could be a full arc. We saw that with Saga where, definitely those first few issues really worked to cement, the sense of place, to move it toward, what could end up being, the overall story. What were your thoughts on this series?
So this first issue, I'm not sure that I loved Brian K. Vaughan's script. Cliff Chang's art is phenomenal and really is the thing that drives this book home for me, because these girls really do look like girls from the 80s. Like the haircuts, the styling all look perfect. The colors are nice, but really it's the line work, the art that looks really great to me. I'm kind of disappointed in the sense that it was like a double issue. It's like 52 pages and not a whole lot happens. I kind of expect a sort of momentum from these mainstream comics, so in that sense I don't think that Brian K. Vaughan delivered with this script. That said, there are some things that are going on in this book that make it feel like it's happening in the 80s, which I really enjoy. On the Cleveland Preserver, which is not the Cleveland newspaper, but there are talks of the Iraq-Iran War, which is, you know, classic 80s. They've got gigantic walkie-talkies and Sony Walkman and all of that business. So in that sense, that's a pretty unique thing. Like, it definitely feels like suburban Cleveland. It definitely feels like the 1980s. So that's one good thing I'll give to Brian K. Vaughan. But really, without Cliff Chang on art, I don't know that I would come back to issue two on this.
I can understand that. As you mentioned, its place in the 80s, something I really enjoy about this is that it beats that trope that I've been seeing so much of recently, where it takes place in a time period, be it the 80s or the 90s or et cetera. And there's constantly jokes of a wink and a nudge to, hey, look at this 80s thing we're doing. And can you imagine we used to do this thing? It's what really bugged me about the television show, The Goldbergs, and its first couple episodes, which I watched. And I just felt like the whole time we're just saying, like, oh, look, here's these silly things that we're doing because it's the 1980s. Here, it's really a sense of place for the story. So I really appreciated that it's unabashedly of that time period without the joking around of that. I can agree with you that really Cliff Chang's art is the reason to come by. But I think there's a story to unpack here, and I think there will be. I think this arc is going to come out very nicely. I will argue that if you look at Brian K. Vaughan's most recent work, you're going to see this is kind of a similar style that he's been going in, where it may not seem like there's a whole lot going on, but the character building, the storytelling is there. And this definitely shows a foundation for what that could be. Every time I finish a trade paperback of Saga, I think, gee, not a whole lot happened between those two books. But, you know, at the same time, a lot did. There was a lot of character interaction. There was a lot of storytelling that was going on. They just didn't really make it very far as far as an actual distance traveled. In some ways, that's the opposite of this, where we actually go to maybe a far-flung future or, again, an alien world. We're not sure what happens toward the end of the story there. I will preface by saying a minor spoiler. Something they find at the end of the issue is a throwback to the future, an Apple product, actually, which was a constant occurrence in one of his other recent books, Private Eye, that he did independently with Marcos Martin, and I believe also Matt Wilson. No, I take that back. Marcos Martin's wife did the colors in that book. I apologize. Apple products showed up quite a bit there, so it's funny to see that that Apple is going to be Brian K. Vaughan's like little side piece he's been thrown into books recently.
Like that kind of like callback device. Like so in Private Eye, is that right?
Yes, yes. Yeah.
So in Private Eye, like the cloud is burst, so none of the iPhone, smart watches, none of that stuff works. So everyone masks their identity wearing these complex costumes. This, it appears like some sort of strange Apple product is something from the future that one of these weirdo-looking guys has dropped off. One of the things that I think was kind of interesting, or maybe something worth talking about, is this this confrontation between the boys who are out trick-or-treating these teens. One of them is dressed up like Eddie Krueger, and one's dressed up like, I think, a ninja, and the other one's like dressed up as a clown. And the tomboy, like, badass character calls one of the kids a faggot and also calls him an AIDS patient. And I'm like, I'm wondering about that. I'm like wondering what your thoughts were on that. Like, it certainly seems like of the time, this is around the same time where the AIDS epidemic is starting to break loose, and people still at that time, especially in the suburbia type world, really identified AIDS as a disease with the LGBT community. I've read some reviews. Some people were pretty off put by those derogatory remarks, and I'm wondering what you thought, Nick.
I disagree completely with those reviews. I do. I mean, on one hand, yeah, I see what they're saying. Jonathan Hickman had a similar reaction when he had one of his kids, one of the characters in one of his books used the term retard. I feel like there, in the same case that it is in here, that just shows where these kids are. It shows the you know, that's how kids talked at that time. Using the term retard is how kids talk today. It's not right, but it's what they do. That didn't really bother me necessarily. I thought that it did, you, as you're saying, put it in a sense of time and place. And it's how kids talk. I mean, to pretend that they don't is stupid. Quite frankly, it's forgetting how people actually interact. On that scene, though, that is one of the scenes where we actually see some conflict, and all of our characters end up coming together in that particular scene. Our main character meets up with the other paper girls, and that's where we really get this like core dynamic really built at that point. And this is the characters we're going to see. I feel like there's a few too many characters. I don't have a good sense of who really any of them are, except for our two main girls. I'm sure as we go on, we'll get a little more out of them. But right now, you know, as far as a setup issue, it gave us a nice sense of, you know, how they talk and their ideas. But I don't remember any of their names necessarily. And, you know, going forward, I'm sure that they will cement themselves more. But I wasn't necessarily, you know, felt like they built any character so solidly that I really got a great sense for them in the immediate.
I totally agree with you on the sense of the swears do not like pull me out of the narrative at all. I do think that it's an important characteristic of the time period, even if it's not an overly positive. I mean, it's just absolutely not positive. It's completely negative part of the 1980s was that fear of the LGBT community and AIDS as a disease state, because we didn't know what was going on with that. And so like, that's really biting, but those are like really biting comments. But I didn't necessarily think that they threw me out of the narrative. And I think that Vaughn actually calls out McKenzie, who's like the main, tomboy character.
Mm-hmm.
Our main character, I can't remember her name. Yeah, you're right that I can't remember any of the girls' names.
Isn't that a little sad? But, you know, that happens. This is a large cast. I mean, sometimes that's going to occur. You know, even introducing four girls in the immediate like that, we'll get to know them eventually. But, yeah, I'm not, you know, I don't remember their names immediately like that. Although, to be fair, sometimes I don't remember the names of the characters in Saga either. Luckily they say them constantly, so you get their names like that.
Yeah, so the only two names that I know are like Aaron, the main character, and McKenzie, the like badass.
Right. Who are the two characters we get the most time and understanding with?
And Aaron is like, so Aaron like actually calls out Mac right after those swears happen. So I think that was kind of like, so I guess that's Vaughn saying, hey, you know, just because I'm...
Uh-huh. This is one of those situations where you're, like, separating the artist from the art and saying, just because a character says this or does this doesn't necessarily mean the author believes it.
I know, that is how I... That's exactly how I took it. Yeah, absolutely.
But I thought that was an interesting point that I had read in a couple of reviews, and I was like, huh, you know, that's something to think about. Certainly it's a point of contention for some readers. I wasn't that thrown off by it. So yeah, I definitely will read issue number 2, which comes out fairly shortly. I think it comes out this week. Next. The story is intriguing enough for me to read, even though I didn't really get a good sense of the characters, even though I did get a good sense of the time. Chang's art is phenomenal. One of the reasons why when the New 52 came out, I actually read for a couple issues Wonder Woman. I would read issue 2, although I'm not sold. I think Vaughn could have given us a stronger introductory comic, but I think that for what it is, it's okay.
I will definitely stick around as well. I definitely think I liked it more than you did, but that happens, and it's just I think it's going to be one of those books that could be really, really great. And you know, it's one of those books that Image is doing that's really cool and different than some of the other stuff out there right now, especially in the mainstream. So I as well will be sticking around for issue two. Well, why don't you lead us into our last book that we're going to talk about?
Yeah. So today's last book, the last book for the month is Not Funny, Haha, A Handbook for Something Hard by Leah Hayes. This is published by Fantagraphics, came out this fall. And it has kind of an interesting story. Hayes was planning to do this by herself, from what I understand. Hayes has previous books from Fantagraphics as an illustrator and musician. Not Funny, Haha actually had a failed Kickstarter campaign that ran in July, or around June to July of 2014. I think after that point, Fantagraphics picked it up and published it this fall. So they must have picked it up about around the time that the Kickstarter failed in order to have it published by now. I'm not sure if Fantagraphics was involved in the publishing of this comic when it was originally planned as a Kickstarter, but they did pick it up afterwards. Not Funny, Haha is a book about two different women who go through different types of abortions. This is a politically sensitive topic. A lot of folks are firmly opposed to abortion, but Hayes makes the, I think, pretty smart comment that no matter what your politics are, people are still doing this on a day-to-day basis. A lot of women go through this experience. So the book as a whole is a kind of a technical, kind of morose evaluation of what happens between the day that a woman decides to have an abortion and the day that she goes back to living, I quote unquote, real life. All the steps in the process in both a surgical and a medical abortion that she has to go through in order to get from point A to point B. With that in mind, I think that this is a really important book in the sense that I don't think I've ever come across any piece of literature outside of the medical community that really fully explains what happens in abortion in a way that's easy to understand, easy to read, goes through the experience of abortion without judging, without talking about politics or laying on some kind of agenda. This is very much like a, this is what happens, here's how it goes. And that's what I think Hayes intended, was for it to be very dry in that sense, that it was moving through this process without laying judgment on either of the two main characters or any of the people that have an abortion on a daily basis. The comic itself, while I feel like the comic is important, I'm not sure that I absolutely loved it as a comic or like as a piece of media. It definitely has this sense of moroseness and a sense of sadness that I think is part of the emotional baggage of abortion. There's a lot of images of women and girls who look worried and upset. There's a lot of imagery of people drinking tea or chatting or like crying in bed. The cartooning is very simple. It's a lot of block text over one panel pages. And in a way, there's not much of a narrative, if that makes any sense. Like, it's definitely more of a technical manual, but really more of a like, this is what happened to this person. Am I making any sense?
I have written down exactly what you said in my notes for this conversation. I agree completely. This is a like 142 page pamphlet that you would get at like the doctor's office that explains the medical side of an abortion, but that could be worthwhile. Some things I really enjoyed are that very early on, the author says immediately, these two girls got pregnant. That's all we're going to talk about. You know, we are not going to talk about their conception. We're not going to talk about their relationship with their boyfriends or the guys they slept with. That's not what this is. And it's even spelled out. It says, that is not the story that we're telling. If that's what you want to read, basically go somewhere else. There's a lot of good things to pull out of this. The book constantly reminds you that despite what you read in this book or any medical pamphlet or read online, you need to go see a doctor. to really find out the correct information, or to see, you know, what is correct for you. It doesn't talk about things from a political standpoint. It doesn't talk about things from a religious standpoint. It just gives a, this is the process you go through while having this procedure done, which is smart. It's a fine idea. The problem I have, though, is that you're right, because it doesn't have a narrative, I question who this book is really for. Is it going to be the book that you hand to somebody who is considering having an abortion? Is it the book you hand to somebody who is going to have an abortion? I mean, it just doesn't seem like that is what the literature really lends itself to. Because it's not really told as a great narrative, I don't think people are going to pick it up for that reason. So, you know, to take such a charged subject like this and present it in such a way, I think limits it into whose hands it's actually going to end up being in. Do you have any thoughts on that aspect?
I think I kind of agree to a certain extent. The having it be a comic book, it does a few things. So I think that the comics in general, are easier to read. One of the things that I've noticed a lot is that cartoonists more and more are starting to get engaged in business type of things, where they're creating creating comics or narrative imagery that helps explain processes or helps explain patient or customer experiences. And in a way, I kind of think that this is like that. You know, I suppose that Fantagraphics would make the argument, and Hayes would likely make the argument as well, that this is a book that every woman should read, just in case this is something that happens for whatever reason, whether it's because they're sick, or because they're not ready for a pregnancy, or because whatever reason it is. And you're right, I did like the idea that Hayes is saying, you know, this is not the book for you to for us to talk about the salacious details of these pregnancies. The important part is that these women are pregnant and they're having abortions. In that sense, it's kind of like a great guidebook for the folks that are thinking about having an abortion, or who aren't exactly certain what whole process looks like. If they need this kind of service or this procedure, what are they going to do? So in that sense, I think that the trite answer is every woman should read this, and really any person that is in a sexual relationship should read this, because it kind of goes through what this is all about. But I do think that without focal direction from, let's say, an organization like Planned Parenthood or some organization offers abortion procedures, I'm not necessarily certain that this is going to get into a lot of hands. It's not a compelling story. That doesn't mean it's not important. It doesn't drive you forward.
Mm-hmm. You know, I see it as this isn't going to have the same kind of effect as maybe the movie Juno did on girls deciding to give their kids up for adoption. And that's just one example of a situation. For instance, right now I'm watching with my wife the show Jane the Virgin, which, as interesting as it was, I was reading this book while watching Jane the Virgin, which is in many ways the exact opposite. The character in Jane the Virgin, very religious. Abortion never really entered her mind, except that others around her told her to have an abortion, which was interesting. But it's just, it doesn't have that kind of mass appeal. And without having a really strong story to drive it, just makes me worried it's not going to get in people's hands, which is too bad. Because while this book doesn't have a great narrative, it does have worth. It's fine writing throughout. It is very compelling that it really does drive you to read more of the story. But the thing is, it's not a story. It drives you to read the rest of this book. Very, you know, at times very technical, but told in enough of a way that it's interesting to follow. But, you know, it's too bad. I hope that more people would read this. I just fear that there's a lot that's, you know, already such a touchy, taboo, if you will, subject. It probably will not get the kind of demand that it probably deserves or could use to be out there.
Yeah, I think that, like I said, I think it's a graphic novel that could be very useful to a large number of people. I think it delivers information in a way that's very accessible. But I think that because of the charged nature of the contents, I think that it would require the support of a national organization outside of the comics publishing sphere in order to bring it to a more wider acceptance. And I think that that's okay. I can almost see this being presented as part of a sex education series, or, you know, as part of a curriculum on women's health. It's not a, it certainly doesn't have a political position. It's certainly unique in that aspect. The book could be seen more in like an academic setting as opposed to out in the wild, if you prefer.
Mm-hmm.
I really do love Hayes' illustration. I guess I've been a little enraptured by artwork from artists who work primarily in graphite, like Sam Alden and Kathy G. Johnson, for a little while now. But another great example of someone who's eschewing the technical, old-school, dark black line comics that everyone is so used to putting out, I think it really works for this book. It has a much more organic feel. It has a much more lived-in feel than perhaps, say, something that's more formally lined and colored.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes.
I'm glad you agree.
Absolutely. No, I think it worked. Something about having those you know, characters kind of sitting by themselves, almost, you know, in some ways maybe it says how personal and of, you know, an option is something that happens to one person at a time. We see very little character interaction with other people in these stories. And there's very little as far as background goes or anything like that. So, you know, all that plays in the art.
I think that's kind of on purpose, right? Like the idea mm-hmm. of like this, you know, how abortion, even if you have a very strong support group,
it's still a very lonely, solitary kind of procedure. It's still something that only you can go through as a woman who's decided to have an abortion.
So I think that the art kind of re-emphasizes the fact that it is hard and it's scary and it's solitary.
Right. Yeah, I would agree with that.
So I think this is an important book. It may not be, it's not the best narrative, but I think that it offers something to folks who would never read a normal pamphlet, but having this cartoon, or I should say this cartoonized, comicized version of this information makes it more accessible, makes it easier for some folks to read.
It gives it some weight in the way that a glossy trifold pamphlet might not.
Great. So that does it for our reviews. Nick, do you have anything you're recommending to readers?
Absolutely. I think I mentioned already, I'm watching Jane the Virgin right now. It's a CW show. Really fun. Watch it with my wife. I suggest everybody go check it out. It is really worthwhile. Again, it deals with the idea of pregnancy in a opposite way that Not Funny Haha does, because all it talks about is the personal relationships and everything else that deals with that. But it's a really fun show regardless. So first season is streaming on Netflix. If you missed it last year, as I did. So now I'm checking out on Netflix, and the current episodes are all up on Hulu. If you're into streaming, and the new season has started. Also on CW, something else I'm watching is The Flash, and I am loving the hell out of this show. Loving it so much, which I didn't think I would. I'm not typically a DC Comics reader, although The Flash has appealed to me in the past. It is a comic book I don't typically read, but the show is everything I love about comics. It is, you know, bright, it's colorful, there's a lot of fun action, it wears its heart on its sleeve, the characters are fun to be around and just be part of. You know, if you are a person who likes comic books, and especially if you're a person who likes superhero comics, this is the show for you. It's something you should be watching. It's something I wish I would have watched earlier. But luckily, the whole first season, also on Netflix. The new season is going on right now, and it's also streaming on Hulu. So
both great things to check out, both from CW, which is a network I watch so rarely, but may have to change my tune too. And then also I just bought the Star Wars expansion for Disney Infinity, which I am also enjoying. It's a kid's game, but there's cool toys and it's all Star Wars, so that's that's doing it for me. We're at peak Star Wars level right now, so
Oh yeah. Nick and I were talking about the three trailers, and I was talking about this big supercut that some fan had put together. I'm a classic nerd. I think I grew up with the original, the original trilogy, and I'm really excited to see what episode number 7 looks like. Hopefully it's not like episode number 1. Although I have to say that there are a lot of folks that like grew up with that, the prequels and really loved some of the things, even though they were, broken in their way, they were able to find things to love about those and enter the fandom in that way. I'm excited for December when we'll see what Star Wars number 7 looks like.
I absolutely am as well.
Clearly, you've bought the video game already.
Yeah, I did. Well, the video game has actually right now the expansions are for Clone Wars and for the original trilogy, but Force Awakens expansion is coming out soon. So
you have to buy the toys to like.
You have to buy the toys to use the characters, but you know what? You get these awesome toys. They're really cool toys that are just littering our living room right now. So anyway, what do you have to recommend to listeners?
So my recommendation this week is yet another fantasy novel, sci-fi fantasy novel. Actually, it's a novella. It's the first novella in Tor.com Publishing's new publishing program, where they're publishing stories and novellas. This is called The Sorcerer of the Wild Deeps by Kaya Shanti Wilson. A really remarkable world-building exercise with a cast that is not very well representative in fantasy novels, to be blunt. The two main characters are gay black demigods, basically. The main character may be bisexual, but either way, we learn about their love story, their romance. We learn about all the things that are going on in the world. We see this really fascinating mix of current scientific thought and mixing it into this like fantasy world. Really unique sense of magic and divinity and divine power. There's just some really cool ideas and some really smart world building all mixed together in a way that really just hits all the right notes. It's not too long. It's about 150 pages, so you breeze through it really quickly. And really, I think this is Wilson's first novella. I think he had a couple of short stories come out with Tor.com, their website, which if you haven't checked out Tor.com and you like reading sci-fi and fantasy, they have free short stories up online. I think they have at least two each month, sometimes more. So there's free fiction to read every so often, so I encourage you to do that. But he's had short stories on Tor.com. I think that this is his first novella and really a remarkable opening salvo from a writer I'm certainly going to keep my eyes on as we move forward. Just a beautiful book. Language is just... Wilson has such a great command of language. I was fascinated by it. I think anybody that likes a good fantasy novel should read this book.
Excellent. Well, anything else you'd like to tell people?
Hopefully everyone has a great and safe Thanksgiving if you're in the United States, and we'll be back at the end of November.
Excellent. Well, with that said, I want to thank everyone for listening to Sequential Statement. Links to the media discussed on this show are in our show notes. Our theme music is by Today's Man off their self-titled album. I'm Nick.
Alex.
And we'll talk to you soon.